You know, if I would have applied myself, I could have gone to the NBA.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. But it's just like, it's been done. You know, I didn't want to, I was like, I don't want to be a follower. Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shea Serrano. And we are back. We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called Six Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the f***ing best.
Each week, Shea Serrano and I are combing through all the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling stories, and then handing out six pop culture themed trophies for six basketball related activities.
Trophies like the Dominic Toretto, I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short-term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill, you might win some, but you just lost one trophy. And what's more, the NBA playoffs are here, so you want to make Six Trophies your go-to companion podcast through all the craziness. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
NBA Most Valuable Player, Giannis Antetokounmpo.
Giannis trailing the lob. Ooh. Giannis Antetokounmpo.
2 seconds. Middleton. Yes! Chris Middleton.
Nice jumper. Got it!
Giannis Antetokounmpo.
Hey there. Welcome to the Eurostep, a Milwaukee Bucks podcast, proudly a part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network and the Eurostep Podcast Network. I am Ty Windisch. I am joined, as always, by my inquisitive, tired co-host, Rohan Kadi. It's an interview pod, Rohan. That's why you're inquisitive.
Okay. See, that makes sense. I'm very excited for this, though, Ty.
Yeah. Not feeling tired anymore. And as
No. This has juiced me up.
Yeah, exactly. We are joined by a very esteemed guest, Coach Brad Fisher. I think you always have to say coach before you say a coach's name. Coach Brad Fisher, who is head coach of the UW Oshkosh women's basketball team and a Milwaukee Bucks fan. And those two things are going to come together nicely on this podcast as Brad has some things to get off the chest about evaluating coaching, especially Mike Budenholzer. I'm very excited for this. Brad, how's it going?
It's going great, guys. I appreciate it. We've had conversations in the DMs in the past about Bud and coaching stuff. So I'm excited to talk it out and talk at Bucks Twitter, which I love being a part of and don't get as great a chance in the season. But our season usually ends right before the playoffs. So it's perfect timing for me.
Absolutely.
Ty, you asked this question already, but I have to get this out of the way. I asked Chase Buford when we had him on earlier last year at this point. Wow. Yeah. do you prefer coach? Is that a thing? Like,
no, my wife asked me that too, because she always hears people. She's not from the sports world. So she asked me that, like, we'll run into people uptown and be like, hey, coach. And be like, first she'll ask if they know my name. And and I do think it's kind of weird. It's just one of those things. Like, I guess people call doctors, and there's a couple other titles that come with it. But coach is a weird one that kind of regardless of what level you coach, like if people know that you do, they just call you that. I've got really good friends that call me that, and their wives too are like, why do you call him coach? Like, no one calls you business administrator or marketing guy. So yeah, that part's weird. I don't care. I mean, I'm not that important, so it definitely doesn't matter to me.
It's the super coach personality guy. I think it's Jason Garrett who was the guy who went in front of the media. It was like, call me coach.
Yeah.
Call me coach.
Yep, that was him.
I've always had questions about that ever since.
Yeah, no, definitely not. I do think there's a lot of scenarios where it's weird. And for my players, sure. Everybody else, definitely not.
I will say, so behind the curtain, I think maybe my first like sports interview when I was on the UW Oshkosh paper was, I don't know if you remember this, was you, Brad. And I definitely went coach. I was definitely sticking to coach. I don't know why in that moment. I do this a lot at the herd games too. It's just in the coaching environment, it's so easy to default to coach. I don't know what I would do if I saw Chason Allen out and about. I don't know what I would do. I want to say I would go first name, but I might go coach.
Yeah, a lot of professors do, and I always wonder if they actually know my name. But I remember our first stuff. I remember the people at school that know what they're doing, and I felt like you knew what you're doing. So that's a compliment. And obviously you've kept moving with it. So it's good to see you taking names here.
Appreciate that. So the feeling is mutual. Before we get to the questions, I got to go through the resume a little bit. Just if anyone who's listening is not familiar, you've been a Bucks fan for a while. We're going to talk about that. But just the coaching chops. I have to take a deep breath. I wrote some stuff down. It's going to take a little while. 10 years now at UWO. 205 wins, I think, officially. More than 200 wins. 20 wins in every full season. 5 total Coach of the Year awards. 9 total WIAC titles. 15 total player nominations, honors for all WIAC first team nods, and another 6 total All-American player nods. So the accolades are there. The career is very impressive. So thank you for gracing our podcast with coaching excellence, Brad.
Well, and I want to start it all off by saying I don't even come close to think that I'm an expert to weigh in on this. I feel like I'm qualified to weigh in on it as a Bucks fan relative to maybe other Bucks fans, but not relative to people that actually really know the NBA. So I want to make sure when I say things that I think are true, that by no means do I think that that's the answer on behalf of all coaches, but it is different. It's a different lens that you look at how the game's analyzed and how it's talked about.
For sure. But it's also, you know, give yourself some credit. Like, well, you are definitely way, way, way more qualified to talk about this than most people. Let's get that out of the way. I know you want to downplay it, but.
No, and I appreciate that, because usually there's a separation from men's and women's basketball too, where a men's coach would be looked at to have a better idea of this than a women's coach. So even from a women's side, I feel like, and I think that's changed. And I think true basketball people appreciate our game more than they did 5, 10, for sure 10 years ago. But as a women's coach, to get asked to talk about the men's game or the pro game is kind of a big deal for us. So I think we're all super qualified to talk about the game, and usually people don't care what we think. So I think in that sense, I definitely appreciate it. And we have accomplished a lot. So I'm proud of that piece too.
Absolutely. So here's a question to bring it back to before all that stuff. What did you get into first, Bucks fandom or wanting to be a coach? And did one stem from the other?
Bucks fandom. Yeah. The plan wasn't to coach. I was going to teach and probably do some coaching and something, but it definitely wasn't going to be a career. And I was a Bucks fan. I mean, the first games, the thing that people younger than me don't realize is the Bucks weren't on when I was young, when I was before, you know, 13, 12 years old. Like, Brewer games were hit and miss. I remember seeing Juan Nieves's no hitter. And I think that was a year where 40 games maybe came to our TVs. Bucks were never on, and they weren't on national TV. So we knew Paul Pressey and Sidney Moncrief through basketball cards, and Jack Sikma and Larry Krystkowiak, like, through basketball cards. We never saw him play. So, and no one was making the All-Star team. So, you know, if all of a sudden the local games started kind of trickling in. I lived in central Wisconsin, so I didn't really feel it until I got old enough to find other places to read about it, Sporting News and places like that. And I actually became a Charles Barkley fan, in part because you could watch him and it was accessible. And it was kind of during the middle of his career, the local games started coming, and we would get, and Channel 24 was the cable channel that came through to central Wisconsin that, you know, now they were doing 10 games a year. And we started hearing Jim Paschke for the first time. And then in high school, I had still never been to a Bucks game. So, high school I'm following, and finally the Bucks with Ray Allen and those guys start getting on national TV. And that was really the first time I watched. I think the first time I went to the Bradley Center, I was a freshman in college at lacrosse, and the next year I bought a 10 pack and was driving 3 hours with one of my roommates, and we had a 10 pack to see Jordan and for the Wizards, and he didn't play that night. And, you know, a bunch of those stories. I was working for the TV station on campus and took my camera to game one of the Orlando series, and my buddy shot it for me, and I did kind of a live shot out front of the Bradley Center for game one of that playoff series. And so that kind of got me wrapped up in it. And ever since, it's been kind of my team. And when you become a head coach, you lose a lot of your ability to put an emotional investment into sports. Honestly, like when I was an assistant, I was so into every sport. And now as a head coach, you got to put so much into your own team and the ups and downs of a season. You can't have a team in every sport that you really invest in. You just don't have the energy for it. So the Bucks have become that team, and luckily it happened. And especially at the time that it has, where now they're so fun to watch and follow.
That's incredible. That just makes me smile hearing those stories. Getting to your current coaching career, unfortunately, such as Mike Budenholzer, you're away from your team due to health and safety protocols. First and foremost, we hope that you are all doing well and everything clears quickly.
Yep.
But what's your overall impression of your team so far? They're 11-4. I know we were talking before we started recording about a tough loss last night. But what are just your overall impressions of the season so far?
Yeah, we've got a really good team. We've got a really senior leading, you know, veteran team. We didn't finish a game that we lost in overtime last night. One of those coaches' losses where you've got a dozen plays that you wish you could do over. I wasn't there for it. So that made it harder. And, you know, our staff is well prepared to do, you know, we work in sync and they're doing what I would be doing. So we've got a good team, and it's hard this year. You see it in the NBA. It's different because they get 82 games. But for us with 25 games, it's hard balancing COVID. And, you know, I feel like I did most everything I could to avoid it. And, you know, now I'm missing games, and I think we're going to just continue to have that happen over the next 2 months. And, you know, we just don't have the amount of games to play with, and, you know, the depth of the playoffs and things like that. Like, we, to get an at-large bid, we've got to be one of the top 20 teams in the country, and we can't afford to drop games. So there's just a lot to balance this year. It's been a tough 3 years, nothing relative to what the world is going through, but just in a straight basketball sense, it's been a tough 3 years to try to figure out how to be successful, keep your players' mental health in the right place, keep them healthy, period, physically and, you know, through COVID. So, you know, it's been a mentally exhausting at some point. So this conversation is a nice little reprieve from going back to worrying about all that stuff.
Well, we've just got one more question that's sort of the parallel path kind of question. Thinking about Darvin Ham, who coached for the Bucks on their game Wednesday night, and potentially will tomorrow night too. You know, what kind of advice do you give to your acting head coach Staples for your team? And you know, is it, do you want them to just coach freely? Are you trying to, you know, send updates and some guidelines, or how do you approach that?
Yeah, we did a lot of Zooms the last 3 days, 4 days now going into this next game to just try to get on the same page. What are the base concepts that, you know, I think, how do you feel, you know, she's had to take over all the prep. I think the NBA is probably a little different. They're a little bit looser practice wise. They don't put as much prep in, I don't think, game to game. At least it's been my sense with the Bucks relative to Utah or some other teams that seem to do a little more game planning. So that part's probably a little bit easier for them. You know, Darvin's been in a lot of basketball, you know, more so than a 28 year old coach, like in my sense. But and for him, you know, I would assume he's got a little bit of that itch with how much we talk about teams kind of sniffing around and opportunities that might come for him. So, you know, in our sense, I tried to take as much pressure off as I could, and losing the game the way we did, I know that didn't help her when it was over. And I think, you know, the NBA, especially with now Darvin and half the team out, you know, I'm not sure how much comes out of that for him other than, you know, a little bit getting his feet wet of being the guy that gets to walk the sideline.
You mentioned earlier that you see the games sort of through a different lens now because you're coaching. What do you feel like is the biggest misconception you see from fans who try to analyze coaching?
I think that the amount that the coaches actually affect is completely overblown. I just think there's an assumption that everything that happens is controlled by the coach or could be controlled by the coach. And I think even for the NBA is even less of that than it would be at our level. Like, we'll finish a 25 game season with 75 probably practices, and Division I, Division II will be even higher than that. They've got way more access. I mean, the NBA, if they got in an 82 game season, if they got 100 and 20 legitimate practices. I think that'd be way too high. That number is probably way too high. There's probably, I don't know if they have 80. Yeah, I remember I've gone to a couple of training camp practices with in the kid era and then the start of the bud era. And it's kind of incredible how much those players already know and the amount of stuff that they rip through if they're trying to put in a package of sideline plays or a package of half court sets and the expectation that they can rip through five on day one and boom, boom, boom. And now everyone's going to go run them and then move it out of the next thing. But there's not a lot of that in game. And I think in kind of following along on Buck's Twitter and trying to be engaged in the conversations that everything that happens tries to get tied back to the coach. And I think there's a lot more nuance to basketball and a lot more nuance to the day to day that just gets lost in that. And I just don't think they have as much control as people feel like we do. And I never feel like I have as much control as people think that I do.
So on that same kind of idea, it seems like at the simplest level, I think all coaches are evaluated. I won't say only, but very strongly just on the end result, right? Did they win? Did they lose? So, you know, the most anti-Bud sentiment was obviously soon after the two playoff series that they lost, because obviously the team doesn't get the job done. The head coach is the one running the show, so he's going to get some blame for that. Do you think it's fair the way we evaluate on wins and losses? And do you see other ways for a typical Bucks fan or two typical Bucks podcasters to evaluate coaching better? Or is it even practical to do that, you know, watching, you know, through screens like we usually are?
To the first question, yeah, I do think it's fair. Ultimately, that's how we're judged. And the wins and losses piece and how far you go, obviously, I think it's got to be relative to the talent that you have. I think there's an ability to talk about overall, what appears to be overall concept schemes and how that relates to your team. I think in the NBA, a lot of the disconnect potentially comes from coach to general manager, the team that's built versus what the coach wants to do probably. Is it even practical? I think for me, the best way to think about it and the way I feel like football is kind of ruined how general fans look at other sports. I think football is so stop and start and the ability to pick apart a play, down and distance, a situation. It's one game a week. So there's been so, but for me, I saw it with the Brewers first, where Packer fans became Brewer fans and looked at baseball as every game was like a Packer game on Sunday when they started watching every day. And if they don't win that Wednesday afternoon game against the Phillies, now they lost the game to the Cubs. And man, you can't have a lineup out there on that Wednesday that doesn't have Ryan Braun and Prince Fielder in it. And the idea of understanding for baseball and now for the NBA, now that people have jumped in the box of what the marathon is like to get to the finish line and what a coach needs to do to manage a group of guys to get the whole group to the finish line, not just the seven best players that are going to play in the playoffs, but the end of the rotation guy that you may need in the playoffs if there's an injury, or Pat Connaughton's development. Cause I mean, even from 2 years ago or whatever, just thinking about where he's come from and all the things that I think Bud has done for someone like Connaughton to get him to be the player he is now by showing trust before the average fan would have thought he was that guy. And I think if you look at it from a football lens of 16 games and say, we've got to win this game this night, this is the one we're watching right now, Pat Connaughton isn't playing 2 years ago in that situation. And I think that piece to me in Wisconsin, at least, has been where I think some of that is lost, where everybody treats every regular season game like it is a must win game and loses the understanding of the long term that comes with it. And now that, you know, resting players and load management and those things are part of it and still not understanding why that's important. I think those are some huge pieces of that puzzle. I think that, that people don't do a good enough job of looking at. And I think looking at where a team starts the season and where it finishes, what the rotation looks like, to me, that evaluation of, are guys getting better? Are they staying engaged? Yeah, there's going to be Piston nights and nights in an 82 game season. But in general, are guys showing up and competing in the majority of those games they think they should win? Are they showing up on the nights when they're playing the Lakers and you know, Brooklyn and whoever the five teams are that year that are the best teams in the league? And it's so hard. And for you guys to do it after every game or, you know, multiple times a week, you have to look at it in the short term. And I just think from a coaching standpoint, you're always looking at it from the big picture of where we're starting on day one to how we start the playoffs. And, you know, we always talk about being the best team, but we're capable of being when the postseason starts. And I think in some sense, that's kind of where the NBA guys and baseball guys similarly with a long season are at. And football is, you just don't have losses to do. And in Wisconsin, the Packers were the thing before the Bucks and the Brewers were the thing. So people have transferred that passion for each game to each of those games. And I think we lose a lot of the perspective on what a season is actually like for guys going 6 months, you know, in 82 games, you know, all these West Coast road trips. Like, you're going to lose three games on a West Coast road trip just because of schedule. And, you know, a guy's hurt on that one, and it kind of all comes out in the wash at the end. You end up, your record is who you are by the end, and usually it works out. And I think that part gets lost in trying to break it down every single day. And that night you tune in, you want to see the best version of them. And sometimes that's not what they're thinking about that night when they show up.
Yeah, you like talking about the long term, I think, is very fitting for this team, considering over the last two seasons, we've seen like this coaching staff take some strides in terms of like taking new defensive schemes, implementing them, because you see they need to do that for the playoffs. It's all about right. The big picture view. Even if they, like you mentioned, they lead to losses randomly throughout the season, a couple of three game stretch where you're just not looking your best. Have you noticed any more decisions besides like player development? You mentioned Pat Connaughton and like other players that have developed, as well as I just mentioned defensive schemes. Have you noticed any other decisions made by this coaching staff that are more focused on the long term rather than the short term?
You know, I thought it was interesting. Obviously, the discourse for the first 2 years was lack of adjustments. I think the biggest thing that probably got lost in the ascension to year one of Bud, where a 7 seed the year before, I think the year, you know, when the Celtics beat him in 7, to go from 7 to 1, that year was a combination of trying to establish a culture with all of a sudden, holy cow, we're one in the league, we're rampaging people, this is how we did it. It let it fly was, I think, part of the very first team. So that's kind of the culture piece of that. And they hadn't really had a chance to rein in what that meant for certain people and certain nights and certain times. And I thought they got caught up that year and I think rightly feeling like what we've done has been super successful. We haven't been forced to think about doing something different. I think those adjustments over 2 years, especially last year, and the bubble is, there's way too many things going on that year for me to think that we really look. Obviously, they look seriously at whether they need a change off of that year. But last year, and I remember, I try to listen to as much Zach Lowe and guys like that I think do a really good job with the nuanced stuff. And I remember I was still at Parkside, so this was probably 12 or 13 years ago, listening, and Lowe might have even been on a Bill Simmons podcast talking about the amount of different lineups that the Spurs were using, just random two centers. And like at our level, we don't have the amount of games or the ability to take losses to do things like that. But just thinking outside the box before that, and that was probably one of the few questions I had about Budenholzer, was if he came from that, why was the first year Bucks so kind of rigid with rotations and how they played and the drop, you know, consistently, and not being a little more flexible? And I think in year one, you're trying to kind of establish an overall sense of this is what we're going to do. Saw a ton of success and then, you know, felt like, hey, no one could stop it to this point. Why would we think, or why should we switch something now? And kind of got caught up in some of that stubbornness of this is the way we're going to win. And I think looking at adjustment wise, you know, I actually appreciate the NBA guys that don't play the young guys. And I think that's probably something that when I read that frustrates people, why is Jordan Nwora getting more time in some of these early games and things like that. And I do think there's a hierarchy to earning your way to legitimate time. Now this year that's been thrown out the window because half the team's out every other game. But I just think it's a lot of subtle stuff, a lot of little stuff that I think he and they have grown more comfortable at understanding now. And I think now I feel like we just got to trust him. I mean, if anything, last year, not just the adjustments during the season and being ready to do more things, but early playoff series struggles last year in kind of each series from game one with Miami in a kind of a dogfight to boom, and then, you know, get hammered in Brooklyn and just getting better throughout the series and doing a lot of little things and, you know, establishing more stuff in the post for Giannis as that playoffs went on. And I think that this actually is a really good staff at watching what they are struggling with and getting better. And I think it took a little bit of time for whether it was confidence or establishing kind of the baseline of, okay, here's in general what we want to accomplish. Now that we feel good about being able to do that, now we can start to branch out a little bit. And we've been shown that we have to. And, you know, I think a Ty had mentioned to me off the side about Bud kind of saying on Zach Lowe that it just worked. And I think there's some stubbornness to that and not kind of wanting giving people credit for questioning the rigidness. Because I think lie detector test, he would admit that, you know, he opened up some of his stubbornness and tried to do more things, and obviously it paid off. And again, I just think there's so much nuance to basketball. The game never stops. The amount of possessions that go back and forth without the coach having any impact on is pretty significant, I think. And it's a bunch of general concepts and trying to get guys to play well together, getting the right groups that can play on both ends and kind of establishing an identity. And I feel like that part with Bud gets lost, that he's developed a team that cares about defense. And that's not the case in every organization, NBA, even a lot of the good ones. And while they might struggle with a drop coverage for, you know, a month, you know, I think the overall stuff that needs to be looked at more just gets lost on the day to day.
Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring this podcast. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System, you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. In hundreds of locations across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's unifiedhealing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
First, the fun stat for the playoff run is they never led a series after 48 minutes, even the one that they swept, just to show. And it's so funny because the whole thing with Bud and the Bucks was no adjustments. Clearly, they figured out some adjustments in every series because obviously they all turned in their favor eventually. But I did want to ask you about the idea of culture. And I think you kind of you mentioned it there and you talked about it. This was something that I really did not think about with Bud until Miron Fader's book dropped, the Giannis book. And there were some of the kid stories in there. And we don't have to relitigate all the kid stuff. I'll never try to make a coach talk bad about a coach. I've listened to enough of the Van Gundys.
I got to go back through some old tweets then, because I've got both. And I have Ken Maka for the Brewers and the end of Jason Kidd are about the only two. I'm the biggest coach apologist. And I know that there's some Jason Kidd. There's a lot of Jason Kidd on there at the end. That's just different. And to me, the culture piece is a big part of it.
That's exactly. So I'm glad you brought us back there from the laughing at Jason Kidd. But I think that's when you really start to appreciate, you know, you think about all that the Bucks have been through since Bud and the tough loss to Toronto, which I think was, people were mad, but I think to an extent, you know, I remember that year we, during the season, were like, are they going to win 50 games? And they went and won 60 games. Like, the expectation wasn't there, but especially after the bubble, I think that's the kind of series that can kind of break a team, right? Especially at the pro level where, you know, a guy can just leave, right? Especially a Giannis whose contract is about to be up. Like, teams break for less than that. That was, you know, an abomination based on expectations and everything else. And I really started to think about reading that book and how the Bucks didn't always have that, about how big that culture piece is. And that's something that, I mean, clearly they're not holding up the trophy if they're not all bought in, all together, working in new guys. I mean, two of their six or seven most important guys were brought in just that year. Actually, more than that. I guess Bobby, too. And they just kept figuring it out. They got everyone to buy into the culture. So, I mean, I think it's barely even a question. But, you know, how important do you think that culture aspect is? And clearly, it seems like Bud has really done well at doing that.
Yeah, without following every team as closely as I do the Bucks, it's hard for me to say how it is relatively. But I get the sense that they do a really good job internally of having conversations about where things are at. I think, like you said, I think the bubble could have broke a lesser team with a lesser coach, lesser leader for sure. And there's no question that there was conversations about doubts that Giannis had or Chris had or Brooke had with stuff that Bud did or their coaching staff believed that the players thought we could do this differently. There's no question they had a ton of those conversations. He wouldn't have come back if they wouldn't have had conversations that led to them feeling comfortable to another year with Giannis's contract kind of on the horizon. If they felt like that was going to jeopardize it, Darvin Ham would be the coach or whoever else would be the coach. But I think, and I feel like they've been pretty tight with what's going on. You don't hear a lot of rumors and drama from people not, and Giannis is a huge part of it, but if Giannis is one, especially during that time, Bud's probably two. And, you know, Chris isn't the guy who's talking, and that's good. You know, they did a good job of having the right guys, that there wasn't the seventh guy that wanted to get some shine and, you know, send something through. But even while that was going on, there wasn't a lot of internal stuff being leaked out about players doubting this or should have done that. And you know, I think the culture piece, again, I don't think Bud is the main piece. I think in the NBA, your superstar probably has the biggest impact on that. But the coach also has to have his Giannis's respect in that piece. And even if Giannis doubted some things, they have the right conversations that led him back to last year. And, you know, and even the amount of minutes he's playing, that was a thing, obviously, at the end of both of those playoff series and him not playing more and you know, him being able to say that and Bud being able to take that and you know, increase it. But there was, I'm sure there was conversations about why he didn't want to do that. And I think their communication and ability to understand the importance of having everybody, at least especially outwardly, appear on the same page, but obviously it's inwardly too. And I think those guys, the chemistry that comes from that piece and him letting them and, you know, people make fun of Let It Fly. And I hate bad shooter shooting, but you know, that part of feeling like, hey, I've got to, you know, if I'm open, I got to knock this down. Like that builds the 9th, 10th and 11th guy to feel like when I, you know, when I get in there, like I'm not that far removed from those other guys. And in some ways we would probably argue that's not a great thing, but I think internally when those guys are traveling together for 6 months, like that's kind of a big deal that the 10th guy feels like he's got a stake in this. And I'm not sure every coach does a great job of making everybody up and down the lineup feel like that. And I think that's why guys like Connaughton develop, because they've felt engaged in the process. And now as their role grows, they've felt like they've been there from the ground floor instead of an outside piece that was kind of trying to punch in. I think that's where Grayson Allen's probably at right now. Great start, struggling and more so trying to find his feet in this group than he is as a basketball player. I think that part is, but that again, that's an 82 game season. We just need him. Bucks just need him when the playoffs start to be feeling good. And there's 42 games or whatever left to get there. And that's why he shouldn't sit the bench for the next 20 games to figure it out in practice. It's just not how it works.
No, that's a fantastic point. That's something we've talked about before in the sense, like, we've seen Grayson Allen sort of teeter between sort of play styles when he's when their player's out versus when the big three is all healthy. That just affirms what we've been saying. So thank you for that. Yeah. Just a question to sort of evaluate Bud specifically. I know we've talked about a lot of Bud stuff. Just as a general evaluation, how would you say he's done so far? And how would you necessarily classify his coaching style? Like, we know we've talked about him as a player development guy versus, you know, someone who just wants to play the young guys all the time or not play the young guys all the time. How would you evaluate his performance and how would you necessarily classify his performance?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I think he's one of the best in the NBA. I mean, I think the list of guys that you would trust to have a team try to win a championship is pretty short. If there's eight in the league, and if there's people that are talked about like that haven't proven that. You know, I mean, it's hard to say because there's some things that annoy people, like the no technicals. You know, doesn't complain to the refs a lot. And there's things that you look at and you're like, I wonder what the guys think about that. But the reality is, obviously, he's won a championship now, so it's been proven that he can do that. But I just think that the process from unlocking year one of a team that hadn't really won anything to just boom, gone. And now I think we just got to look at it different. And you know, they should probably be doing more experimenting for the rest of his time. And the hard part about the NBA is at some point the message is going to die. And there's just like, you're just not going to be a 12 to 20 year guy anymore with the same franchise in the NBA, but he'll be able to go to another franchise and I think shoot the same adrenaline into the program. So, you know, I still kind of view him as a player's coach just because I feel like these guys really, really care about defense, which is not, again, always the norm. Guys keep coming back. Giannis is obviously part of it, but guys want to come back. George Hill came back. I mean, guys that go are back. Wes is back again. So again, if Giannis is the top of that list, they still got to come back. And the coach is still talking more than anybody probably in the locker room. So you still got to be willing to come back to listen to him. So I think some of those things that annoy us about what we see are completely different on the inside. And I think there's a level of respect, obviously, that grew. I think that the embrace between Giannis and Chris and Bud last year is probably my favorite part of the whole deal. Like, I felt more vindicated for him last year that I did for Giannis, which is as much grief as he takes for the no bag and things like that. I felt as much for Bud, and because that was more internal, that was way more internal within Bucks fans. And I know he walked around, you know, I don't feel pressure like that in my job, but I know he walked around Milwaukee feeling half of the eyes or more, being like, this is the reason we're not winning the championship, which I think was completely unfair. And for him to get that, I was as happy for him as anybody. And I think the players, by the way they've returned, the way they've acted, have kind of shown us that he is kind of a player's guy, regardless of if he's not player's coach in the buddy sense where we go hang out and do stuff, but he's player's coach and kind of letting them do their thing. And, you know, some of it drives fans and Bucks Twitter crazy because we all think it should be done a different way and a lot tighter and more specific things that we want to hear said in press conferences and you know, sound drops in the fourth quarter on ABC, and none of that stuff matters at all.
Yeah, it seems like to him more than anybody. I do think when we get like the little peeks through to the more authentic stuff, like in the last All Access when he was talking to Brooke and he basically said, I see you don't have your shoes, like shoes, socks, I'll take you however you bleep and come, Brooke, like miss your buddy. Like you can see like those little moments. Yeah. Like, yeah, it's a lot. He's not walking around the facility. Like my favorite Bud moment ever, the funny Bud moment, the winning it was the favorite one, but it was early in the season. It might have even been preseason. And it was a national TV game. He had to do the interview. And they ask him like what he's seen or what he's been looking for. And he literally said, just hoping to see our guys play 5-on-5. And it was like, well, you're going to get that, bud. You will get that. Like, I just think this is a whole Bucks wide thing. Most of the guys, it just feels like they put up, even Giannis sometimes I feel like gives these answers where it's like, what does that even mean? Like, are you just saying something at this point to make people stop asking questions, which is frustrating to us a little bit. But I do think, as you said there, it doesn't really matter at all internally. Like, clearly there's no communication issue within the Bucks, because if there was, it would be like some of these teams where it feels like every third practice there's a players only meeting and the details get leaked. You know, who doesn't want
shots? Boston.
What'd you say?
Boston.
Boston.
They have a players only meeting every other week.
when you mentioned a certain coach who gets talked about like that, I was going to say, did that coach just become a GM or?
Yeah. And I think the other thing they appreciate is he's never made it about him, and he doesn't have the PR guy that Monty Williams has. And he's not going after his brand. Like, he's not building a coaching brand.
He's not wearing Mike Bud hats to.
Like he's just not. And I think I would assume the guys appreciate that he's not standing, because he does get to talk more or as much as anybody. He's not standing up there trying to take credit for stuff. And I think he does a good job deflecting. And, you know, the option is, either you talk about yourself, you say nothing, or you take all the blame. And he kind of sits in the say nothing camp, but he's never, to my memory, put any blame on a player or, you know, thrown a guy under the bus. And I think pros, you know, I don't know a ton of pro basketball coaches. I know some baseball guys and football guys. And, you know, I think they'll always say like the fastest way to lose a team and lose guys is how you talk about them in the media. And I just think he's done a great job of always praising his guys, never putting blame on individuals after bad stuff happens. And I, that part alone, I know it comes out as nothing, but I know the players appreciate it. They never have to open their phone to Twitter and see that Bud just drag them across the floor. And if he's upset about something, it would always be talked about in the team sense. And most of the time they had that conversation in the locker room before he talked to the media. So I think those things get lost in the shuffle. And when we want content that's a lot more interesting, and he's just not willing to give it. And I think long-term, that's a great thing, because that was not the case with the regime before. And I think there's a lot of places around the NBA, it's the reason teams are who they are, and that they're not the Knicks and the Lakers and you know, like Boston, I feel like is kind of now with Smart will say something and then Jaylen Brown's weighing in and Horford's trying to jump in on it. And there's just always something. And I think, yes, it's the Bucks guys, but it's also how much respect they've built for each other. And the coach has to get credit for that if you're going to blame him for losses and rotations and things you don't like.
Just a real quick example on that, something that just made me think about this. Did you guys see when I think it was Mike Malone? I don't think there was an interim coach, but he basically after a game said, like, I think it was Bones Highland just didn't, or someone didn't know the playbook. Am I getting this confused?
It was an interim head coach.
It was an interim head coach.
Yeah.
It was like a player just didn't know the playbook or something.
And he said I thought he would know more about the playbook.
Yeah.
And I was kind of thought like, we have never, like you said, we've never gotten anything close to that. Like, there's been times Bucks players messed up really bad, and Bud, bless his heart, just went out there and said, like, we're going to watch the tape. We're going to get better. We didn't execute. But he's never going to be like, oh, Chris messed that up. Like, it's true. That really just does not really.
And it happened in football this week, too. Mike Zimmer, I think they asked him about Kellen Mond. Do we need to see Kellen Mond? He's like, nope.
See him every day.
See him every day. And that's the same thing. Like Jordan Nwora, when they asked about him, Jordan's getting better and, you know, he's working on some things. The answer probably is he ain't ready. He can't guard, but I don't trust him. And I would rather go with a vet who I kind of know what I'm going to get than have this roller coaster right now with a guy that I don't know what's going to come. And it's not a good answer for us because we're like, guy can score and, you know, we need this and that. And on his end, it's like, I know what he can and can't do. And he might be ready to go do it, but we're not ready for it. And a lot of times in those sense, his teammates aren't ready for it either. Like I play kids that I trust, but I also play kids that their teammates trust. And I don't know, in a lot of these cases with some of these guys that we think should be on the floor, like the guys that play a lot might not want to play with them. They might not, if I can't trust you're going to be in the spot that I need you to be in, I'd rather have a guy out there that can't do what you can do, but it's going to be in the right spot. So I know what I can and am going to do. And again, that part, we would never know because those conversations aren't happening, but we're also not, he's not telling us that. And I think that's a good thing. And he protects those guys like that.
I know we talked around it a little bit. Let's just get into some fun Bud frustrations that we've seen from across Bucks fandom. And it's like, oh, why does Bud do this? Why does Bud do that? This is your chance to respond. First off,
beautiful.
We've seen a lot of discourse that Bud does not get technicals enough. He's not standing up for his guys.
I think that's
he's not defending
number one this year, right? Because I feel like this year with everything else going on, we're not seeing as much strategy. I think it's like the text is what I see the most. Do you agree, Rohan?
Yeah, I think the tech thing is what we're seeing the most. It's like when he actually does get one, we're like, oh my God. I think he got a technical in the Pistons game, I believe.
Accidentally, he did, yeah.
Yeah. What is your response to that, that he doesn't get techs enough?
That one's interesting because I think, A, if we had one shot technicals and played 82 games, I would get a technical at least every other game, personally. Like, I get warned enough, but I also know it's two shots for us. Sometimes the ball, depending on when it happens, like, it feels like a big deal. In the NBA, it's a throwaway. Like, I'd take a technical every other night. That's what I'm curious. Like, what do the guys think? Do they feel like they're being supported? Like, I think he's been semi-aggressive, sometimes probably reckless in challenges for guys when they ask for challenges. Like, and that's a way to show support. I mean, for me, technicals, if it's not an egregious call that you just want to light a guy up on. And now with replay, they don't need to do it as much as you used to when that wasn't an option. If you're not doing it because you just lose it, it's only because you're trying to protect a guy or support a guy when he's upset. And so I guess the question would be, do the guys feel like he's not supporting? I would assume based on the track record here that if that were the case, he would ramp it up. And my guess is he just doesn't feel like it affects things that positively. And there are relationship deals, obviously, with officials that you're going to see in the playoffs and guys that we all know that we don't want to see as fans. When they have the Bucks, Mark Davis was the one with George Karl where it was always like automatic. There's going to be a T and some sort of confrontation when Karl had the Bucks. And, you know, the fact that Bud doesn't have that, maybe is a good thing. So I don't know. That one's a tough one because I would be curious if guys feel like that would help more. But I feel like he would have done it already. I think he's pretty smart in that sense of understanding if that could help him or not.
How many texts do you get?
I've had four or five in 10 years.
Oh, okay. So you have been judicious then, knowing the cost.
Yeah. I got two as an assistant. I got pretty gun shy, and my head coach at the time was not happy. And I lose it quick. Like we put in a lot of time prepping for games. So when there's something that I think is going to happen from film that happens and doesn't get called, like I go from 0 to 100 fast and have to get talked off the ledge sometimes. But yeah, I mean, I've got, I think 4 or 5 in 10 years. So every other year, maybe I get one, usually, hopefully never in a situation to hurt our team. But yeah, the NBA, I just feel like they want to get rid of them. They should go back to 2 in the ball, and people might shut up a little bit, but then I don't know if guys would want to call it, cause it would be a more meaningful play too. So it's kind of 6 of 1, half dozen.
Yeah.
You said that, you don't know if the guys feel like Bud's defending him. When you've gotten technicals in the past, have you feel like your team has rallied around you in that sense?
Yeah. I mean, again, I think there's 1 or 2 times where I just lost it, but there's other times where it's a buildup of, there's been 3 or 4 calls, and now this one, you kind of feel your bench off to the side, kind of everybody gets up and is like, where's the call? And you kind of feel like, okay, if they're all into it, A, the call, but also it's usually a culmination. And I feel like that he has been a little bit in that place where it's a culmination technical and not an individual situation, but it's probably a little bit different. And I would think it's a little bit different for him, especially with some of the whistles that Giannis has had over the course of his career, that would probably be the place where, you know, I would have felt like there was some opportunity there to get a little bit more aggressive in protecting Giannis. Cause I think we all would feel like there was a different whistle for a stretch there with him compared to other superstar guys. But yeah, I feel it. It doesn't happen often. I'll get my warning. For me, a warning is a T, kind of, because then you got to shut it up, but at least you know you kind of got your point across. So I know NBA, they're not really handing out warnings. So that's probably the equivalent for us. Now, if I had to count warnings, there's probably been 75 and whatever, 250 games.
That's incredible. Just a side question before we get back to the frustrations. This is something that I think about pretty often. Bud, you'll see him late in a game. The Bucks can be up any amount, and he'll call a timeout piss because somebody messed something up. And I remember, I think it was the last UWO game I went to that you were coaching, and it was the same deal. I think you had a team tripled up. Like, it was crazy. Like, they were and I was like kind of looking around, like watching the game. I look over, and you're like crouched down at the head of the bench, just like so pissed. And I was like, what possibly could there be? Is that just how you need to be as a coach? Like, is it you always just have to find something? Like, because there's always it's never perfect, right? So do you need to start like kind of seek out things, or is that just the natural state of being for a coach?
I think it's a natural state of being. I think a lot of times at the end of these games, it's guys that, in his case or my case, women that they think they should be playing more. And then you see something that either you went through a scout report or we go through every day in practice that you don't do. And it's kind of your opportunity to go, you know, this is kind of why, like this, I need you to be able to do this because this is something we do all the time. And I need you to prove you can do it when you're on the floor. That doesn't matter right now to the overall score, but I need it to matter to you. So when I put you in next time in the second quarter, when it's a 4-point game, instead of now in the fourth quarter, when it's 18, that I can trust that's going to happen, or that it's not your habit that you're not going to be able to get over this ball screen or be in the right spot on this rotation. And, you know, I think I like to think that good coaches care about that stuff. And that's part of player development, that there's some accountability at the end of the game. It's super important to us that when we get to the end of a game, that we've got freshmen and inexperienced players, that they play like, they look like our team, that it's not a free for all. And there's been some great free for all moments for the Bucks. I mean, there's been a couple in the last 2 years of 18-point leads that become 6 in, you know, a 3-minute span. And now guys are walking to the table to come back in, and, you know, guys throwing in by, you know, I remember Thanasis throwing a inbound pass to the other team, you know, in a 6-0 run in about 20 seconds. And that's ingrained in a coach, like that, you know, we're 16-point lead with 4 minutes or 2 minutes isn't safe. Like, that's the psycho part of coaches, where everyone is already on their phones in the gym or walking out the door. And you're like, we could still lose this game if we turn it over six times and foul and, you know, foul a 3-point shooter, like that's legitimately in our heads. And I think that's probably pretty standard across the board.
That's incredible. Okay.
Another frustration that we have here is this came about during the playoff run. I think it was the final. Where was it? The Eastern Conference Finals when we got, or maybe it was the finals when we got the video inside the locker room. We got Bud's pre.
I know it's coming.
Play random. This has been something that's just been, it's just been memed to death. And honestly, I didn't hate it at first because I was like, we've never seen this before. He could be saying it before every single game and we just don't know about it. But talk to us about it.
That one probably bothered me more than anything, because more than almost all of them, because A, everything that goes from those clips to TV is censored by the Bucks. There are people okay it. I always have friends that bother me when they'll text me and be like, you know, he doesn't say anything, and you know, why doesn't he coach him? And you know, he doesn't draw anything up. Like, well, that part's already done by the time they've shown the clip, or it hasn't happened yet. And I talk, and I remember tweeting about it, like, teams have their own languages. So random to the players is not mean random to us. It's not literally just do whatever. And like, we talk about playing with snap and playing, it's a way for us to talk about our pace. Like, we got to play with some pop and some snap. And if people took the clips that I wanted, that was okay with other teams hearing, like, I would say stupid words like that all the time too. And my assumption is random just meant we can't be predictable. We can't do the same thing every time down the floor. We have to switch up our entries. We have to get, and when you're playing in flow and you're playing in 24, like, you're not running a set every time. You're not even running a set entry. So to me, the message is be unpredictable, get to different spots, use all your actions, what, you know, all of our concepts that we've talked about wanting to do tonight, A, B, C, and D, like, let's do A, B, C, and D. Let's not just do A. And then, you know, when we find a couple things that work now in the second half, we'll talk about doing B and C a little bit more than A and D. And I just thought that guy, he was like tagged with being stupid, talking like people are acting like he's an idiot talking like that. And I think that little phrase that I was ready to start using it this year, because I think it's a good way to talk about not being so damn predictable that you bring the ball for us, bring the ball up the right side of the floor every time because you want the ball in your strong hand. Like, we need to bring it up the left. We need to be able to bring it up the rail. And I actually thought it was a nice tight way to talk about just being a little bit more malleable in your stuff and not letting the other team sit on things. And I might be wrong. It might mean something completely different for them, but I know the players know what it means, and it does have value to them. That's the part I thought that was really goofy.
I think you're probably onto something here, because especially the way the Bucks offense started to work, incorporating the dunker spot more, and I am not a super technical basketball mind, but just clearly there's going to be a lot of relocation involved, because you can't sit in the dunker spot.
And it's different people.
Yeah, exactly. So there's so much movement. And I think if they did the same like relocations every time, that would probably be really bad, right? I think teams would figure that out. They would know when to cut, when to intercept passes. Like, I think it did make a lot of sense. I think I probably made some jokes about it. I never took it as something that was that serious, though, because obviously we don't get anything from Bud anyway. We're not going to get anything from Bud in these clips. But it was funny, just the outsized reaction to just play.
Yeah, people went wild on that one.
Yeah. Kind of related to that, not running enough plays. And this is something that you said as well. There's just not as much sets. Some teams run more, like you mentioned Utah before, Phoenix. There's teams that double drag screen like every possession. Bucks don't really. They start doing more pick and rolls. They do some pick and pops, but a lot of the time it seems random. It's not random. Maybe it seems random to people. But what do you think about the criticism of Bud not running enough set plays?
Yeah, I mean, that stuff that comes out, I think, and probably the time you question it most is obviously when things gum up and when you get to the playoffs and you're grinding out possessions. And you know, in that sense, I think about that shot that Middleton hit in game six, the elbow kind of fade jumper, the 19 feet or whatever it was, and great action with three different, you know, exchanges of switches and you know, I think there was a blur in there and dribble handoff and stuff like that. Like, and, you know, it was the biggest shot. And the plays in that sense don't have to be as good because you've got guys that can knock down shots with people in your face. Like, I always laugh when you know, NBA guys tweet out these plays and they're like, hey, here's Horns, Floppy, Bulls, Mavs, and you can use this with your team. And a guy's shooting a contested fadeaway 23-footer and knocks it down. Like, that works for 32 teams in the nation. And, you know, so I guess from my experience, what I say to that is the best teams that I had ran the least amount of plays. And you can scout plays and you can jam up plays and you can have a plan for plays. And being able to play on the fly and having concepts that people have to guard, really good motion concepts or really good five out concepts. We run a five out, so I watch the Bucks as much for our own stuff as I do for the enjoyment of watching them. And the more you can play without running plays, the harder you are to guard. And there's got to be a balance. I was a huge set guy when I got to Oshkosh and had this whole book of, you know, I can't wait till I'm the head coach to run all this stuff. And it works for a while. And then pretty soon there's enough film on you and the playoffs, there's so much film and so much time to break games down that everybody knows everybody's stuff. So either your sets have to be so good to get you to the spots you want. And guys are probably still going to have to beat in an ISO or a post up and have kind of the reads that they're going to play off of it. But to me, the less plays that you run, the better off you are. So, you know, I think it's, obviously there's got to be a balance. And when you go six possessions in a big game without scoring and getting a good shot, like everyone says, we need a set. And we talk about the same way, like call something to get everyone on the same page. But you know, I don't know that that's a bad thing, I guess would be my answer. And, you know, when you lose, if you didn't score enough, like that's a place you can look, but they probably were doing a poor job with their base concepts and a poor job with their execution that, you know, that's kind of the boring stuff, but we needed to screen better and our stuff would have worked better. And we wouldn't have had to talk about plays. So from a coaching standpoint, that's the first place my head goes in that.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but it's more of like you're saying you don't need to necessarily run as many plays because once you're in that situation, you should be able to know what you're supposed to do.
Right.
It's like a feel, it's a recognition thing. You have to be able to recognize this defense is in this formation. We need to know how to attack that immediately, every single possession.
Yes.
Am I interpreting that correctly?
Yeah. And it's where guys are on the floor and it's why lineups construction is important. And in a five out, whether they're using the dunker spot or in the old spot in the natural, we still use their old spots and we've incorporated dunker a little bit more. But when Brooke Lopez catches at the top, and Chris is on his right and Giannis is on his left, like he should have something and they should have something that they all kind of know, okay, this is what probably will happen here in either direction. And you don't have to call it, but the next time down the floor, if Connaughton is the one who trails and ends up in that spot, and now he's got Chris and Giannis, like now two different things are happening that way. And it's automatic down screen, curl, pop, dribble, handoff. It's Chris is here and I'm playing with Giannis. I'm going to pitch it to Chris. I'm going to go see if I can get a pin down on Giannis to get him on a curl. Or if I go to Giannis, I want a clear space to give him this right rail to go attack. So I'm going to slice cut or we call it a slice cut, but cut underneath him to try to drag my defender through off of his guy's back, see if we can rip through. I'm going to rise up behind him. Like those things we would never consider any of that plays. But if we had to draw up, which I do, like I see stuff like that, I know it's not a play for them, but I make it a play for us because I've got five players that I can say, okay, this will be the honest person and they run it. And then it becomes a play for us. And then the next year it is just part of our offense. And I think especially with five out, when there's a lot of versatility in your spots, you can do a lot more of that than rely on pin down, you know, curl, pop, punch it in the post, Laker cut on the basket cut. Let's fill that. Like that stuff you don't have to do because everyone's kind of got a feel for who's next to them and what's the next thing to do and what their concepts are. And that becomes the hard part to guard because Connaughton's not going to do the same thing every time that he passes it to the right. If he does four different things, it becomes impossible to scout and say, well, he's going to do this in this spot. And that's where, to me, if if you get really good at your concepts and your motion, you don't have to rely on calling plays out that got names that everyone in the gym can see, including the guys that have watched every game you've played this year. So that part, I think, ideally, you'd like to get to where you don't need them.
Every time, two things. One, every time I talk to someone who's very smart basketball, I realize I have so much to learn about basketball. Just like,
oh God, that's how I feel exactly.
Things thrown out, like, oh my goodness. And number two, I might have forgot. I had a really good number two. I think I forgot it.
Oh my goodness.
It's the worst thing in podcasting. Yeah, I don't know.
You'll get back.
Yeah, we'll find it eventually. The next Bud frustration, Rohan can't even believe me at this point. We touched on this a little bit. We had the media thing. We really touched on that. But the too much love for drop coverage, which I think, you know, we touched on earlier, that probably did adjust more than he has said so far. But yeah. And we talked about this a little bit. But were you frustrated by – were you more frustrated by Bud doing so much drop or it becoming such a talking point to where – I remember there were times last year in games where they'd maybe dropped half their possessions – and you would still see every game, oh, all they do is drop, all they do is drop, all they do is drop. And I would remember, like, I would be mad at Bud about something, and I would have to, like, quote tweet and be like, they actually didn't, but this is why I'm upset this game.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember being frustrated because I thought it got really predictable. And I think the good teams, when there's an ability to go every, you know, 7-game series where you can adjust and get comfortable with stuff, I thought the predictability of it was the problem. I didn't even think it was always the execution of it. And I don't think it was the concept of it. I think the idea of contesting a guy from behind on a pull-up jumper with a 7-footer in front of him, it, conceptually, is not an easy shot. I don't think there's 75 guys in the league that feel super comfortable taking that 10 times a game. And I think everything we love about analytics, we should have loved drop coverage. Like, it puts them in the spots that ideally you'd want guys to shoot at. And then there was teams that had guys that liked that shot that took advantage of it. There was teams that weren't that good that started hitting that shot on nights that, you know, games got uncomfortable that you felt it too. And I think, I definitely think he adjusted way more than he admits to on that and the versatility of that. And actually, honestly, it taught me to have a lot of different ball screen coverages. Even though I thought we were really good at our base coverage. And I think that probably was one as a coach when I was like, it seems like there's at least something to switch it up here. And, you know, there'd be a random switch and Brooke would all of a sudden, he'd have all of his limbs out and, you know, he'd be stretched out and it looked like the guy was uncomfortable. I'm like, every once in a while, just pop that out there and see what happens. Like, and I think that's the part of getting comfortable with year one, trying to prove he was, you know, the right guy for the job and get them the culture of we're going to win all these games. And then getting a little more comfortable in his skin of, you know, if we lose tonight in Portland, because we tried working on these things, it's not the end of the world. And I think, you know, that's a tough feeling. Being okay with things not going well, you know, and the prime time when the lights are on is not a comfortable feeling for anybody. Like, you're not out here just, you know, kind of ad-libbing it along the way just to see how it goes. Like, you want to feel prepared and go with what you want to go with. And I think that maturation for him was probably a big step. And, you know, as a coach, that was one where I was like, there's a lot of ball screen defenses. Like, just try something for two possessions, see what happens.
Yeah. It's sort of like, Have you considered doing something else? Like,
yeah,
just even just a little bit.
Because when it would happen accidentally, it would kind of be fun. You'd be like, "Ooh, there, here's a switch," or
"This is
fun. Or Brooke is guarding at the top of the key now, and this guy's sizing him up. Like, let's see what happens. Like, just show you what was going to happen."
Brooke Lopez deceptively long.
Oh, you beat me to it, Ty.
Yeah,
oh, I loved it.
But one thing we haven't seen, thing.
Rohan. I'm sorry.
It's go quick.
I think it really underscores, though, how hard the league is having a time with the replacement players, though. Just talking about Bucks especially, but all teams, you know, players are used to relying on each other being in the right spots. And a Bucks, especially a team that calls less plays, now just like, okay, Javonte Smart, you're going to play real rotation in this game. I mean, obviously, the game where he and Mamu plays 44 minutes, that's just a free-for-all. But even like the Raptors game, when he and Mamu are in the rotation, they've been around the team, but obviously they don't have the game reps that the Pat Connaughtons and the other guys out have. So really it just underscores the difficulty of this season for everybody and for the Bucks.
Yeah, and teams that rely on continuity. And you know, the teams that have a big playbook, the old Flip Saunders playbook was 300 plays, and guys would come in and they'd hand them the playbook and it's their job. They expected them to know it. And you know, if you run a lot of sets, like you can get guys to memorize sets and probably jump in a lot easier than playing in flow and knowing what a good shot is and those things. So that's a great point on what this season and why for me this whole season is, where are you at? Do you have your guys in the playoff starts? Are you at least playing one series at home? Do you maybe hopefully have the right bracket and the right teams that you kind of want to match up with? But ultimately, I'm not sure now that they've won it that they really care.
Yeah.
One more thing that we've seen from Bud over the past couple of years is no matter what happens in the middle of the game, a lot of Bucks fans have seen the efficiency charts. Charts for Bud sideline out of bounds plays from first quarter through third quarter versus in crunch time, because every time in crunch time, not every time, obviously, but it feels like it's just Chris getting the ball in the corner, do something. I know there's a lot of other, like each action is different when getting him that ball in that spot, but it's just like every time it happens, they're like, oh, there's this again. Teams have snuffed it out in the past. Is he a little too reliant on that at the end of games? Do you feel that way?
As someone who's much less smart than him, I'll say it makes me uncomfortable that you see this, you kind of see the setup, and it's if I'm thinking of the right one, because it's been, I mean, they've been running it now for 3 years, but the long curl that loops into the corner and now it's a turnaround catch and shoot. And there's, that one I think is probably fair, and you know, there's some other options again out there that probably are a little bit cleaner, but yeah, you kind of have your pet stuff, and sometimes you need someone to tell you that it's not as good as you think it is, and I mean, obviously they have a reason for continuing to go to it, so there might be things that they like about it that we don't see, but that's one. Like for me personally, like I think with inbounds plays are the easiest to scout, because you can literally click the blob list and the slob list, we call them, and they'll just rattle them off, and you see the setup and it takes 30 seconds to draw it up and have all of them on paper. So for me, those are as much about disguise as they are about what the actual play is. And when we get in games, I probably shouldn't say this, but the one we play, I'll be listening.
Coaches tune in.
Because when we play in games where we're in control, almost everything we run out of the timeout, not everything. A lot of the stuff we run out of timeout, we'll never run again. And it's a lot of times it's just messing around to see what might work. And then probably not using the same again, because it's literally board erased, see what happens, gone. But especially with inbounds plays, it's as much about, okay, we have this setup and this is what we like to do. Let's use the same setup and do something different. So at least the next time they see it, they've got a guess between A and B. And if you can get C, D, E, and F over a 5-game stretch, because you got to mess around a little bit, you know, A, you might find something you like, but also you've disguised it. And that's the one thing I don't like about that sideline play, is there hasn't been A, B, C, and D off of it. And it does feel like you just always kind of know this is what's coming.
Maybe it's like, we've done a rock, paper, scissors analogy on this pod before, but maybe it's like, you call out rock every time and the opponent's like, there's no way he can't,
yeah.
There's no way it's going to be Chris in the corner, and then he takes the shot.
Yeah.
I do love, as an aside, what game – do you remember what the game was, Rohan, the Giannis get the hell out of the way play? That was earlier this year, right? When they inbounded it to him at half court, and he just steamrolled.
That was the downhill. Was that Cleveland?
Charlotte.
Downhill where he spun it off the bottom of the rim.
That was Charlotte, yes. And I was like, that is such a fun out-of-bounds play. Because A, we just haven't seen it. It's not the Chris play. And B, it's like, how many other teams have a guy that would make sense for? Like, maybe the Lakers have two of those guys, but there's not many guys in the league where it really is like, oh yeah, we just need this guy to get ahead of steam, and that's the most important thing. But that made me go like, oh, maybe that's this year that what they're going to mess around with is the sideline out of bounds plays.
Yeah. And I think like there's some times in coaching where stuff like that becomes like, there was a stretch where the football play in college where guys would, everyone line up out of bounds and all of a sudden they break out to break a press. Yeah. The NBA now, because you can go in the backcourt, they'll put a guy in the backcourt that forces the defense to go back there with them. Like there's things like that kind of get innovated that then get beaten to death. And I did feel like, now that you say that play was something that we would see more of. And you're right, I just don't think there's that many people on a downhill slope that can put that kind of pressure on the rim. So Detroit's not looking at that and going, oh, we can use that. Yeah. And that's no offense to Detroit, but that one was pretty unique. So again, that's a good example of like, he's not stupid, yeah. But it is. I wonder about kind of the disguise on some of those things.
Yeah. There was also that play against the Clippers. I believe it was last season, which ends with a Giannis game sealing dunk, where that was sort of like the tertiary outcome of the play rather than the primary, like the Charlotte one,
yeah,
where it ends with a Giannis punctuation dunk. What was that? That was last season, right? That wasn't,
I think
this
it
season.
Was. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. This
time is weird, but no, it's just, it's fun to see the innovation with sort of the out of bounds plays, especially like you're mentioning going more to Giannis in these situations instead of going to Chris in these situations. Is that going to be what's tampered or not tampered with, but like sort of tinkered with this
year? Don't say tampering around.
I know. I just cost him a second round pick.
Yeah. That's the part I'm jealous of. Cause I do think they have, with how many games they have, they just have so many opportunities to just kind of throw something random in there that one of the assistants has been thinking about and be like, let's try it. And yeah. I wish we had a little more time personally, game time for us to tinker like that.
And I think about too, just like player time, the difference, you know, Chris and Giannis have been playing together for 7 years now. Like that's always what kills me, how you can build a sustainable college program. Cause it's your event. Mm-hmm. It's their fourth year. Like yeah. that's what is there a buck in their fourth year right now? Is Wara in year three?
Yes.
I think, I don't know if there's anyone in year.
Dante three. Is Dante year four?
Dante might be year four. Dante yeah. DiVincenzo is the most seasoned possible vet. Like, obviously, it's not apples, but in time, it is pretty wild to think about.
Yeah, you rebuild it so often. And they do it with personnel, obviously, and the older guys, but it's new to the team. So that part's a little different. But yeah, by the time we get comfortable with them, they're ready to graduate and move on to the next thing. So that part, that's a challenge.
Yeah, how do you sort of handle that sort of situation with the tons of turnover and stuff like that, and especially keeping the dominant winning ways? How does that sort of translate year to year, roster to roster? I know like there's going to be incumbents year to year, which helps obviously when you're trying to build a program. But how do you keep that message going? You mentioned earlier that the message sort of dies at some points in the NBA. How do you keep that message going, like your personal message to your team?
Yeah, the good part about college, that's the good part about kids graduating, is they're not there long enough to get sick of you. And I think that's the part with the NBA where, you know, guys that have been there for 10 years in a franchise, the same voice gets lost. And, you know, I think in college, the culture piece is probably a little bit bigger because you've got to recruit them to get there more so than the NBA does. But I think relating it back to the Bucks, like I think that's part of Bud's, to me, charm with Giannis, is that they can bring in however many new guys, six or seven new guys last year with that core, and they have the same core values, they have the same culture, and the expectation we always say is you become us. When you come here, you become us. We do not change. We're not going to change who we are to become what you are or what you need. And I think they do a great job of that. And that's probably the easiest way to say it with our college program is, when we recruit them, we have these values that are expectations of you need to be able to do these things. And if you do these things, you know, I think you're going to be successful. And I think the message I'm sure in free agency and through the draft is, as they're interviewing these guys and figuring these fits out, is we've got this core group of guys that believe in practicing this way, preparing this way, traveling this way. And we need guys that kind of adhere to that, or veteran guys maybe that haven't always been like that, like Boogie was, that are willing to become that when they walk through the door. And And I think, you know, he was a good example of what the Bucks culture was. If you need an idea of what the Bucks culture is, how he came in and carried himself, talked about the program and the guys and the staff and all that is a perfect example. And that's in the short term, because we turn over so much, we have to stick to the things that we say are important to us and make sure we find people that believe in the same things. And I think the Bucks have done a better job of that in the NBA than most, at least since Giannis has been the guy. And obviously he's a huge part of why that is.
It's funny that you mentioned the Boogie thing, because while you were talking, I was thinking about him, and I'm not going to get into. I can't do anymore.
I listened to the last one.
You take a break for now. But I did think about that while you were talking about setting the values, because that was one where he had talked about, like, the Bucks were pretty extensive, and I think interviewing him and working him out, both aspects. And I was like, wow, so they are really committed. Like, they're not just going to let. Maybe these 10-day hardships are different, but, you know, with a guy on an NBA deal. It seemed like they were very upfront about setting expectations, making sure everyone was aligned. And I thought that was a cool look inside what that process is probably like for everyone they bring in.
And even the way they separated, it feels pretty amicable for what could have been a pretty tenuous situation. And I do think the Bucks do a great job with agents. I think they're as good as most in the league. But it seems with the way things kind of split yesterday that they were all kind of on the same page of what everyone was looking for. And it didn't seem like a surprise on either side, even though we were all like, what? Yeah. And I think, you know, again, I think that's a credit to what they have culture wise.
Yeah. It was definitely a divide. it caught us off guard.
From the outside, for sure.
It's just, oh boy, that was an interesting podcast.
I'll say, coach, we've kept you way too long. You've been very generous with your time. Thank you so much for hopping on. Before we go here, when we have guests, we always ask, this is a little different. Usually it's podcasters or something. Is there anything you would like to plug, or do you just have any last thoughts about the conversation here about coaching and about Bud?
I personally don't, because I coach Division III college basketball other than support women's sports and watch women's basketball.
That's a good one. I think
you'll be surprised if you appreciate the nuance, the X's and O's. I think the women's game has a ton of good basketball stuff that people are missing. But I really like the mid-range theory. And since he's become a good friend through Twitter, I think the mid-range theory has helped with my analytics. And I think, you know, someday I want to talk about basketball more. I'm jealous of you guys that you talk about it like this every day. So I just appreciate, again, letting a women's coach come out and talk basketball. And hopefully there was something that people liked from us talking the coaching side. Cause I do think there's a lot of unfair criticisms of Bud and just coaches in general that people just don't have a great feel for.
And just quickly, the mid-range theory, that's Seth Partnow's book, correct?
Yeah.
I know I personally learned so much. Like I've been taking notes during the episode. I've been taking like usually it's beforehand. I'm doing it during the pod. If I've learned a lot, I'm not going to say it. That sounds too.
No, I was going to wrong. If wrong.
No. I realized what I was saying, so I caught myself. But I know I personally have learned a lot through this conversation. Thank you so much for joining us. This was absolutely a pleasure. Hopefully, we can do this again sometime soon.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. This is fun.
But yeah, thank you so much. Thank you to everyone for listening to this episode of the Eurostep. Make sure you leave a 5-star rating on Apple, Spotify, wherever you can. Subscribe to the YouTube, Substack, follow us on social media. Go Bucks. We will talk to you next time.
Thanks, guys.